This is Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the artists and music behind the 2015 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School and previews upcoming performances. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and can also be heard online at aspenpublicradio.org. I'm Chris Moore, and today we talk with Russian-born pianist Vladimir Feltsman about two concerts he's presenting in Aspen this week that took several years to prepare. We'll also talk with violinist Simone Porter as we anticipate her performance of the Barber Concerto this Sunday. Then we'll chat with young conductor Matthew Forte. Pianist Vladimir Feltsman had his debut performance with the Moscow Philharmonic when he was only 11 years old. As an adult, he became a refusnik and had to wait many years before ultimately being able to move to the United States. He has many recordings of Bach, Beethoven, and Schumann, as well as Russian composers. In addition to teaching and recording, he has spent several years organizing concerts of composers who suffered under the Soviet system for failing to conform to the new bureaucratic demands for socialist realism in the arts. Two of these concerts take place Wednesday and Thursday at Harris Hall. Here is Vladimir Feltsman explaining the importance of these composers whose music has been suppressed.
Russians call them lost composers or unknown generation of composers. All of them in the first program has been very strongly influenced by Scriabin, naturally. And I'm talking about three names. It's Roslovets, Protopopov, and Mosolov. And these people, these three composers of absolutely highest order, are not really known even in Russia. There is an explanation, I actually kind of three of them, contrary to Rachmaninoff and Prokofiev and Nabokov, Shalapin, Stravinsky, many, many people, artists who left Russia and had very successful careers, these three never left Russia. That is basically an explanation why they never basically hit it big, because fame, for better or for worse, for Russian artists, always comes from outside.
This reminds me a little bit of Entartete music, I think it's called, with Hitler and the Nazis and the composers whose music was really destroyed by the Nazis. And when I first heard about that, I always thought, something like this, I'm sure, has happened in Russia.
Stalin and his henchmen took really good care of the art and music in particular. And from early 30s, not dominating, but the only acceptable style of writing, be it music, literature, poetry, or painting and sculpture, was the method of socialist realism, so-called. And so these three guys felt out of power, out of favor, and basically had to hustle for the rest of their life without any official recognition or position or teaching job or basically anything. That is the first program, Scriabin, Roslovets, Mosolov, and Protopopov. Second program is Shostakovich, Weinberg, Ustvolskaya, and Schnitke. Shostakovich and Schnitke are known. Weinberg is getting known, so it's well-deserved if some late recognition, but better later than never. Ustvolskaya still remains one of the most difficult, enigmatic composers of 20th century, which I admire greatly.
Well, I think a clarinet trio is a work of absolute genius.
And I look forward to hearing what we will be playing. And Weinberg, whom I knew very well because it was a family very close to my family, and I basically, it was like second home for me, and I call him Uncle Matic. So this is special personal connection, and I picked up. He wrote enormous amount of music, actually more than Shostakovich. He was very, very fruitful. But I picked up work 24 preludes for cello, of course not on 24, but it will be 6 preludes of cello, which is one of his masterpieces. And that will be the very beginning of the second concert, after which will be Viola Sonata by Shostakovich, one of his very late works, one of his best chamber works. Actually,
backwards from your expectations, uh-huh.
Yeah, and so after the break will be Ustvolska Clarinet Trio and Trio Piano Trio by Alfred Schnittke, who somehow happened to be my dear friend.
You mentioned Weinberg, but also I'm curious, since you did live in Russia in your younger years, did you know Shostakovich? Did you know any of these other composers?
I cannot say, no. I cannot say that I knew them well, but Alfred was a friend. I knew Nikolai Karetnikov, Denisov, and Gubaidulina, of course. But real friendship was with Schnittke and Karetnikov. And with Shostakovich, I lived at the same apartment building for 20 years. So I used to see him almost on a daily basis or sometimes in elevator. But that said, of course, I would never say that we have been friendly or friends.
Stalin and Hitler, between the two of them, did so much to stop the conversation in the arts and to stop the development, the natural progression of the arts in music and in all of the arts.
No matter how murderous and criminal he was and how much blood on his hands, he was very, very savvy and brilliant in very negative way guy.
Mm-hmm.
Because on one hand, he would criticize and put out of business Prokofiev and Shostakovich and make them fear for their life. And the other hand, at the exact same period of time, he would give dacha to Shostakovich and a pretty significant sum of money both to Prokofiev and to Shostakovich from himself. Okay, so he was very manipulative son of a gun.
Yeah.
And I think his relationship and his attitude and his manipulation of art and artists has been much superior to Hitler's.
Mm-hmm.
Hitler was much more black and white guy than Stalin. And Stalin, actually, because he considered himself to be a poet, because he wrote some poetry pretty extensively, some of which is actually published. And he considered himself a connoisseur of literature, poetry, and so on.
Well, he sort of took a wrong turn, I think, when it came to the arts, because I think the arts suffered terribly under him.
The arts suffered terribly, and under him, not counting the war, by conservative estimates, 15 to 20 million of Soviet people were murdered or passed away of starvation or were killed in whatever fashion or manner.
Mm-hmm.
15 to 20 million. Compared to him, Hitler's treatment of his own people was vegetarian, if we're talking about numbers.
I want to change the subject and ask a little bit about what you do as a teacher and what you look for in students.
Good topic, because last week, Friday, actually, Piano Summer at New Paltz, which is we are running, my wife and myself, already for 21 years, was just finished. Well, teaching is kind of came to me naturally, a very important part of life, and it becomes more and more important as the years go by. Because, well, it's very, very simple if I have any... approach to life or any motto, which is kind of silly even to talk about it, but it's very simple. All that is not given is lost. Really, it sounds too grand maybe, but it makes sense to me very tangibly. So if I have a little bit of something, then I am very happy to give it away. And when I see somebody who can actually take it, that is, give me actually bigger joy than playing a good concert, because you play a good concert and it's gone if it's not being either recorded or video or whatever, which doesn't happen too often. But when you meet somebody special who can actually benefit and grow, then to me it's a privilege, it's a big joy. So teaching, yes, it is important. Function of the teacher to me is very simple, is to make your student self-reliable, independent of you. So, because unfortunately, sometimes there is a dependency on a teacher which sometimes lasts for a lifetime. That's not what I'm looking for. I'm trying my best to just give them something that at some point they can teach themselves and become self-efficient.
When I watch you perform, one thing that strikes me is just the authenticity of what it is that you're giving to the audience. You have a way of hearing what the composer is trying to say, and then you give your authentic interpretation of it. Are you looking for that in a student too, somebody who has the potential at least to be able to give their authentic?
This is exactly, it's basically the same thing, because authenticity, what does it mean? It means direct connection to whatever music you do. And it's not only to that music, but through that music to the source of it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, and when it happens, then there is no middle people between whoever plays something and what it is. So it becomes all one. And any authentic connection is unique. There is no two connections that would be two of the same authenticity. It just cannot happen.
Mm-hmm.
That's what makes it basically interesting and worthwhile, because if it could be like one definite rendition of Bach or Chopin Nocturne, then why bother for anybody else to do the same fugue or the same nocturne? Mm-hmm. By definition, it's not possible.
Exactly.
It's a very, very good thing. Also, since we're talking on such serious topics, music to me, actually, as almost anything else, but since I'm a musician, to me it's more tangible, is a tool of knowledge, and it's very powerful. Like for Bach, music was tool of knowledge and tool of worship, which is the same.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so if people connect somehow to that, you know, my function as a teacher is done.
When my wife and I go to a concert and it's not a very good concert, or there isn't that authenticity, I might say to my wife something like, I don't really feel like that person deserved my time for these last 2 hours.
Well, it's very simple. You are right. Of course, it's everything is in the eye of the beholder, something which you like or I like, somebody dislikes, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
But to me also, if I have to put it in words, it's very simple. You have to earn the right to be listened to.
Mm-hmm.
You
mm-hmm.
have something to say, which is yours, uniquely mm-hmm. yours. Not like ego yours. Not you are using whatever work in hands to display or to express your personality, quote unquote. This
right.
is very flawed approach, which I cannot stand. I have an allergy on that.
Uh-huh.
When you have something and there is this authentic connection, then you deserve this right to go on stage and to say something. It doesn't mean that everybody will like it or will accept it, but it will have certain intrinsic value.
Right, right.
Which for me, I feel it from even before people start to play. It's already clear.
You just watch their body language or something?
What is going. Now, well, it kind of, I cannot explain it rationally, but it's
right.
very tangible.
Do you feel like you have a good feel for a performer, a young musician who's gained some technical skills but hasn't really truly found their own voice?
I can see that this mm-hmm. kid, he or she, could get it,
mm-hmm.
could
mm-hmm.
get it. And it's good enough, because from that you can build and you can start. And also there are people who would play brilliantly, technically, and will be absolutely in possession of all facilities, and they will never, ever get it. That's it. It's like, I don't know, I have a dog has a sniff.
Right.
I just sniff it. I feel it. And
right.
I don't need any proof. I know that I'm right 10 times out of 10. It's like instinct. Thank you for calling me. Take care.
Enjoy your day.
Mm-hmm.
Bye.
Thanks.
Thank you.
If you've just joined us, this is Festival Showcase on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Chris Moore, and I've been interviewing pianist Vladimir Feltsman, whose concert on Wednesday features music of Scriabin and composers who were inspired by him. And on Thursday, he offers a second concert of Shostakovich and composers inspired by him, whose music was so suppressed by the Soviet government. This Sunday at 4 p.m., violinist Simone Horder performs the Barber Concerto with the Aspen Festival Orchestra, conducted by David Robertson. Welcome back to Aspen. You have a long history here, and I'm sure a lot of friendships that have developed over the years.
Yes, it's amazing to be back. I consider this place musical heaven and just paradise. It's my favorite place to be.
I can imagine. Now, you started out here as a student, and how old were you when you were in one of the orchestras? Which orchestra were you in at first?
I came to Aspen for the first time when I was 10 years old.
Are you one of those people that started at a very, very young age, like you can't even remember first picking up the violin or something, like 3 or 2 or something like that?
Guilty. I started when I was 3 years old.
Oh my gosh. Whose will was that? Was that the will of your parents? Was it your interest? I mean, how does this kind of thing get started at that?
Actually, my own interest. My parents are both professors of international studies and had very little knowledge or exposure to classical music. They had this one CD that was a collection of Puccini arias that mm-hmm. I became obsessed with when I was about 2 years old. But they noticed my interest and based on that began taking me to more classical music concerts, and somewhere along the way I became infatuated with the violin and began pestering them until they finally let me start when I was 3 and a half.
Finally.
Yeah.
It took so long.
It took a really long.
And then, of course, they had to face every child who starts playing the violin sounds awful in the beginning, and I'm sure you were no exception to
many
that.
Many a squawk and squeak, yeah.
Now, your professional career is really taking off, and you're very, very much loved here. I imagine you've done a lot of chamber music performances. Have you done the Bach, the solo partitas or anything?
Mm-hmm. I've performed some solo Bach. I consider those just sublime works of mm-hmm. art. I'm playing a couple of recitals right after Aspen in September, and I'll be doing the G minor sonata number 1.
Mm-hmm. You start with solo violin with the Bach, for example. You go to some chamber music that I'm sure you've done, and then, of course, playing with a symphony orchestra. How are those different, and how do they affect each other?
Well, of course, every different genre, as I say, of violin playing requires a different approach, but they all communicate. No mm-hmm. one is just an island. You need to be a soloist, sometimes an orchestra, in chamber music. You need to be a chamber musician when you're a soloist. You need orchestral mm-hmm. experience when you're playing a concerto with orchestra. So all of them inform each other. For example, when I play the Barber on Sunday, there are going to be many elements of chamber music, because that concerto, almost more than many other violin concertos, is really a conversation between mm-hmm, the mm-hmm. violin and the orchestra. The parts are just so intertwined, and we share so many phrases and lines that the communication is very much like playing just in a smaller chamber ensemble. My experience in orchestra also just lets me know what's going on behind me when I stand on stage and how to work with the conductor. So you really need to be a great chamber musician, great orchestral player, and great soloist if you want to do any one of those.
Right, I can imagine. Tell me a little more about why you love Barber so much. I just have to tell you that I consider the Barber Violin Concerto to be unique. It has so much heart, and it's so intimate. And I sometimes find it hard to find the words for what it is I love about it so much. So I'm going to ask you.
The Barber is a very special concerto. The range of its emotion, it covers sort of the entire emotional gamut from just mm-hmm. the most exhilarating last movement, which is just electric. It has this frenetic energy that just never stops, to just
that's
the,
where the virtuosity
yeah exactly to the elegiac second movement and the pensive first. The Barber is interesting because the first two movements are very, the first movement isn't this sort of giant war horse like many standard concertos have. It's a little more contemplative or meditative. It's sort of curious. There are some really incredible sensual moments, but it's maybe more intimate than other first movements. The second movement is really a gem in the entire violin repertoire, I think. It mm-hmm. has some of the just most absolutely gorgeous melodies of, I think, all time. It's mm-hmm. so expansive. It's that's a movement that I can't listen to without getting goosebumps. Mm-hmm. And the third movement is sort of this paroxysm of just energy. It can be almost startling, but I think in the context, all three movements really work together and create a very interesting painting.
Are there composers who have approached you and said, I'd like to have you play my sonata or my concerto or whatever? Are you approaching composers and saying, gosh, I'd sure like you to write something for me for the violin?
I have never commissioned a concerto or any other violin repertoire yet. I think that will be a future endeavor.
Have you at least said pretty please to somebody?
I haven't. Okay.
But that's something you're hoping to do.
I hope so. Absolutely.
Are there composers who are alive today and composing whose music you feel a particular affinity for?
Yes. I hear a lot of great contemporary music because I go to the Colburn School and I live across the street from Disney Hall where the LA Phil performs. And their commitment to contemporary composers exposes all of us who live across the street to it. I'd say my favorite is definitely John Adams. I adore him. And I know that he just wrote this new violin concerto for Leila Josefowicz, which was just premiered this year and is coming to LA next year, which I absolutely cannot wait to hear.
Well, you might be able to play it someday.
Who knows?
I want to ask also about your living and working and schooling, I guess, finishing your schooling in Southern California, and you've played with a lot of the orchestras there, and of course here. Are there places like Aspen and some of the places in Southern California where you feel a special affinity for the people that you, it's more than just, okay, I've got a gig here in this town, I'm going to play for these people and then move on. How does it feel to you when you're at a place where you feel like you know a lot of the people in the audience?
I think for that very reason, Aspen is such a special place to me. This is some of the most exciting place to perform and also the most terrifying.
Sure.
I really feel like I grew up at Aspen. It was the first place that I interacted with other young musicians who had the same passion and dedication that I did. And my summers here were so formative and continue to be. I am so excited to perform next Sunday because I'll be on stage with some of my closest friends in the whole world. And it's just playing with colleagues and people I'm close with is and respect as musicians is incredibly special. The audience is also a little nerve-wracking just because there are so many musicians and music teachers, other soloists, conductors who know this piece, who have played this piece, who just have their own opinions, and people who I look up to and respect so very, very much. So it's definitely nerve-wracking, but I love the challenge and I look forward to coming back to Aspen all year.
Simone, thank you so much. I really appreciate you spending your time with us. And we're thrilled that you're welcome back to Aspen, like I said before. And we'll look forward to seeing how you perform on Sunday with the Barber.
Thank you. Can't wait.
We've been talking with violinist Simone Horder, who performs the Barber Concerto this Sunday and will be at an artist dinner this Thursday. Finally, let's chat with a member of the American Academy of Conducting at Aspen Orchestra, directed by Robert Spano.
Well, Matthew, last week I interviewed a young composer named Melody, and this week I'm interviewing a young conductor whose last name is Forte. Do you feel particularly lucky to have a musical name like that?
Around my neck of the woods in Michigan, Matt Forte is actually not so famous as a conductor, but as a football player in Chicago.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So I can't tell you how many people I've disappointed who have come up to meet me and realized that I don't actually play for the Chicago Bears. So in that way, the name isn't so fortuitous. It's good for music, isn't it?
Let's talk about the conducting program. You get to drive the big rig right away. I mean, I saw you conducting the last 20 minutes of Mahler's First Symphony. This is a very, very meaty kind of opportunity with a full symphony orchestra.
Yeah, we're all very lucky to be here. There are 12 of us. And the thing that distinguishes this program, I think, from most other conducting programs is not only that we get the opportunity to conduct these big works, but we also get to play in the ensemble as well. All 12 of us conductors get to play in the group, and this is a really unique opportunity. I play the trumpet.
Well, it's pretty much every Tuesday, 4 o'clock, and these are free concerts. Do you and the other three conductors, let's say, if you're doing a four-movement symphony or something, do you get together? Because sometimes yes and sometimes no. Sometimes it seems like a unified performance, in a sense, start to finish. And other times, it seems like you're having your interpretation of the fourth movement and somebody else is doing their interpretation of the third in a more separate way.
Well, this is one of the reasons why playing in the ensemble for your peers is so useful, because we don't necessarily get together and talk about the interpretation of a given piece. But we do witness the rehearsal process throughout, and we kind of get a sense of what each of us is going for, respectively. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And by the way, it is absolutely fascinating, having studied these pieces before we get here, seeing what all of our really intelligent musical perceptive colleagues have done with something that we obviously have our own strong opinions about. It's great.
Right, exactly. And then on top of that, then you have the strong opinions of the conducting coaches, as it were.
Yeah.
I interviewed Robert Spano at the beginning of the year, and he said, I have to walk that fine line between interpretive, unique, and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And have you had some of the conductors actually come back and just say, you know, I'm sorry, that was very, very clever or very creative, but not really right?
Yeah. Well, it differs, obviously, by teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And it differs by the extremity of the error, right?
Right.
You can have artistic license to a point.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, one of the things that's done is that if our tempos are way off, we're very quickly reminded that the tempos
right.
are way off.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit more lenient with things more subjective than that. And I think that's actually one of the benefits of this program is that in general, the coaches, especially Maestro Spano, he really lets us do the thing that we want to do here
mm-hmm.
so that we get a remarkable amount of autonomy in the rehearsal process, which mm-hmm. is really helpful. It's absolutely wonderful to have a coach that will help you through the entire process. But ultimately, here we're preparing to conduct on our own.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's recognized and encouraged here. So a lot of the coaching actually takes place prior to our experience rehearsing and in the concert mm-hmm. and immediately following, which is, I think, a really good system. We're lucky to benefit from it.
What are some of the things you feel like you're taking home with you from your experience in Aspen this summer?
Maybe the biggest thing I've learned is just how collaborative conducting can be, especially mm-hmm. with musicians of the caliber that you find in Aspen. An orchestra is a complex machine, and a conductor is simply one part of that machine. One has to acknowledge the incredible aptitude of the musicians in front of oneself and simply guide them rather than being autocratic. It's something that's been really reinforced to me here just because of the quality and the talent of the people I stand in front of
mm-hmm.
every day, really. That I don't necessarily always have to impose my will, that we create a product together that's beautiful. And when you let go like that and simply make music with your peers, it can be an absolutely wonderful transcendental experience. And I think that's the thing that I've been learning not only this summer, but when I was here last summer.
Matthew, thank you so much for your time coming in this morning. I know that that's a busy, busy program that you're dealing with here. So appreciate your dropping into Aspen Public Radio, and we'll look forward to seeing you at the podium another couple times.
Thank you so much, Chris.
A member of the American Academy of Conducting at Aspen Orchestra, directed by Robert Spano, dropped by the studio to talk to us about this conducting program. This has been Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the artists and music behind the 2015 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School and previews upcoming performances. Please join me Tuesdays at 3:30 for more interviews. My name is Chris Moore. We'll be right back.